the unequal or patriarchal society that he then tried to change or improve.
Yes, you know, he grew up in deep segregation, a time when the South and much of the country was still dealing with racial segregation. And yet he, you know, empathized with the black people that he grew up with. And, you know, when he became governor, he announced in his inauguration statement that the time for racial discrimination is over, shocking his audience.
Thanks for the reminder that he became governor of Georgia. He was elected in 1970 before being elected to the presidency in 1976. I want to ask about an aspect of this. We'll hear a lot in the coming days about his life of service to others, which lasted long beyond the presidency. But to state the obvious, he was also an ambitious man who tried to rise in the world. How did he match his ambition with his ideals?
Well, he was extremely ambitious. He was very intelligent. He was always the smartest boy in the room in school. And he, as president, he always thought he was the most intelligent, most well-read person in the room when he was working in the White House. So he, however, was faced with a dilemma in this because he had ambition. And yet, as a Southern Baptist, he understood that the greatest sin was pride. And so he knew he had a lot of pride and ambition. And so the way he reconciled this was to say to himself, I will achieve power. I will do whatever I can to win the presidency or the governorship. And then when I do, I will do the right thing, regardless of the political consequences. I will be righteous. I will figure out what's the best thing to do, the most intelligent thing to do, and then pursue it. So, you know, he decided on the Panama Canal Treaty, which was a very unpopular move. He decided to pursue this in his first term, even though his lovely wife, Rosalind, who had very good political instincts, urged him to put this off until his second term. Mm. Jimmy said, no, I've got to do it now.
He was criticized by Ronald Reagan then for turning the Panama Canal over to Panama, still being criticized by President-elect Trump even now.
Exactly.
I want to ask about one other thing. In 1979, he gave a famous speech about a crisis of confidence in America, doubt about the meaning of our own lives. I'm quoting his words now. A loss of unity of purpose for our nation, the erosion of our confidence in the future. This was well received at first, as you write. It was then criticized. Does it seem somehow prescient today? It sounds like he's talking like someone in 2024.
Yes, you know, he went on in that famous speech to say something quite extraordinary, saying, too many of us now tend to worship self-indulgence and consumption. Now, you know, he's taking a page straight out from Christopher Lash's The Culture of Narcissism, which he had just recently read. But this also spoke to his Southern Baptist sense of morality and righteousness. And it was a sermon. And I think it's very prescient today because we're still living in a culture, a political culture that is quite narcissistic. So I think history will judge Jimmy Carter as a president well ahead of his times. He's, I would argue, the most intelligent and hardworking and decent man to have occupied the Oval Office in the 20th century.
Kai Bird wrote The Outlier, The Unfinished Presidency of Jimmy Carter. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now we'll turn to the international challenges Carter faced during his time in office, issues still confronting the U.S. today. A hostile Iran, a peace that's more elusive than ever between Israelis and Palestinians, deteriorating relations with Russia, and a rising China. For more on the late president's foreign policy and views on global affairs after his presidency, I'm joined by Richard Haass. He's president emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations and worked in the Pentagon during the Carter administration. Good morning, Richard, and thank you for being on the program.
Good morning.
You know, it was foreign policy that many point to as Carter's undoing as president. Americans were taken hostage at the U.S. Embassy in Iran for 444 days, and that was seen as the reason he lost his reelection bid. But when you look back at the legacy of his foreign policy as president, what defines it for you?
Well, first off, I think you're right. If he had maybe sent one more helicopter and the hostages had come back, he might have been reelected. But the larger theme of his foreign policy, I actually think, was quite interesting and quite successful. He was a man of peace, but he wasn't a pacifist. Mm. He was both a realist and an idealist. So he could advocate for human rights. He could bring, you know, the Israelis and the Egyptians together. But he also signed an arms control agreement with the Soviet Union. He normalized, established diplomatic relations with China. And he signed the Panama Canal Treaty simply because he realized that was the best and only way to keep the canal open, despite the pressure from the American right not to do it. So to me, he was able to live with contradictions, and maybe that's one of the things the job takes.
You mentioned a few landmark moments during his presidency, the peace deal he negotiated between Israel and Egypt in 1979, paving the way for the Panama to take control of the Panama Canal. He also established diplomatic ties with China. He had an openness to the world. Mm-hmm. But when he signed the Panama Canal treaties, he was widely criticized domestically, and he talked about how he saw U.S. relations with other countries based on, quote, fairness, not force. Since then, the U.S. has prosecuted two controversial wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and right now the incoming president is threatening to retake control of the Panama Canal. So is Carter's principle of fairness, not force, something of the past?
I'm not sure I would have ever articulated it that way. I think he would have done better if he had said, look, our goal is to keep the canal open and functioning, and this is the best way to do it. The idea of fairness, I don't think necessarily plays as in the sense of patriotism. This is a rough world at times, and other countries aren't playing fair. But again, the larger point is American foreign policy since the get-go has had a tension in it between idealism and realism, between principles, but also politics. And it affected Jimmy Carter, just like it will affect Donald Trump going forward.
A lot of his legacy, people talk about the time after his presidency, all of the time that he spent on peacemaking, on humanitarian issues, on promoting human rights. But you've written that he's been underestimated and his legacy, especially on foreign policy, wasn't heralded enough. Why?
Well, in part because he was, just what you say, he was so extraordinary as an ex-president. And I think, you know, people focus on that for good reason. But then they're a bit critical or harsh in saying, but he wasn't that good as a president. And again, I'm not going to defend everything he did. You know, inflation was out of control during his presidency. Some bad things happened on his watch. He allowed himself to become hostage, if you will, to the hostage crisis in Iran. But overall, it's a pretty good record. Solid relations with the Soviet Union and with China, the breakthrough peace in the Middle East, that's still the foundation to the extent there's any order in that part of the world. The Egyptian-Israeli agreement not only set a precedent, but it's still there half a century later. He also increased the defense budget towards the end and built the foundations and the basics of what became our ability to project military force in the greater Middle East. This is a pretty impressive set of accomplishments.
I will point out, in his later years, he became quite critical of the peace process between the Israelis and Palestinians and Israel's treatment of Palestinians. But when you look at the world today, are there lessons that the United States can take from Carter's legacy on foreign policy with the geopolitical challenges we face today?
The biggest lesson is the need for diplomacy as a tool. At the same time, we've also got to be strong, that it can't be one or the other, that you've got to somehow have both in your kit bag when you approach this world. I think that sums it up.
Richard Haass, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 8:19. It is a Monday. Happy to have you along with us for the show this morning. Still to come this hour on the program, we're going to hear about the history of Fleetwood Mac. You know, it was 50 years ago on New Year's Eve when two new musicians joined the band. You may have heard of them, Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham. And of course, that changed the course of the band forever. We'll hear that story still to come this hour, plus news at 8:30 on WPR.
If you know a Christmas carol, the chimes will ring a few bells. Poor old Trotty Veck has lost his faith in humanity, and he believes that his poverty is the result of his unworthiness. On New Year's Eve, he is visited by spirits who restore his faith and show him that nobody is born evil, but rather that crime and poverty are things created by man. Join us for The Chimes tonight at 9:30 on Chapter a Day.
Support for WPR comes from Schultz Nonprofit Law, sharing WPR's mission to inform and inspire, and providing advice for nonprofits, cooperatives, and other social enterprises. SchultzNonprofitLaw.com.
Support comes from the Kenosha Community Foundation, a public charity dedicated to keeping local resources local by encouraging families to begin tax-advantaged giving, strengthening nonprofits, and improving lives. Visit KenoshaFoundation.org.
Morning edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. A dense fog advisory is in effect for a good portion of the state until noon today. Otherwise, mostly cloudy throughout the day. A few pockets of sunshine, especially in the south, with high temperatures above average for this time of year, still in the 30s and 40s. Overnight, low temperatures in the 20s and 30s. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Drexel University, whose cooperative education program positions students to explore future careers and discover their ideal profession before graduation. This is experiential education. More at drexel.edu. From the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. From ECMC Foundation, whose North Star is to eliminate equity gaps in post-secondary completion by 2040 so that underserved learners have greater opportunity for social and economic mobility. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Unfortunately, or fortunately, some of you may already know this, we are now squarely in breakup season.
Holidays are supposed to make you feel warm and cozy and connected, and if you don't feel that, it can be kind of a die marker of where you're at in your relationship. And then the new year coming, people, you know, asking themselves what they want, including, is this the love that I want? And so lots of evaluation. And so this is a breakup season.
That is John Kim. He's a therapist and the author of Breakup on Purpose, a new book that makes the case for 8 different types of breakups. We started by talking about breakups and the new year.
I think it's great that there's a new year, you're excited and you want some new things for yourself, but I think you got to bring it back to you and your own relationship before wanting to look for love.
Now, according to your book, not all breakups are created equal. Tell us about a few of the 8 categories you wrote about that makes and what makes them different.
Yeah, I've always thought no one's actually examined the different types of breakups because each one will require a different prescription. So the flat soda breakup, this is a breakup that should have ended years ago. The blindsided breakup.
I just got that flat soda reference. Yeah, I just got
yeah. And the blindsided breakup is one where it just comes out of nowhere. I've actually been guilty of blindsiding someone, which is horrible. The big one, this is the first true love, and usually this is young love, but it's also probably unhealthy, and that's why it felt so big. It's when our hearts were made of powdered snow. Then there's the soap opera breakup, the I need to get a restraining order, the breakup that, you know, is toxic and people are slashing tires and making threats. Another one is the almost relationship breakup, and this one's really interesting. It's the relationship that was almost a relationship but never was. This is actually hard because what you're losing is secondary loss, all the things that could have been. So when we're dating someone, we're thinking about baby names and thinking about, you know, the future and what we could build. So all of that is lost and there's grieving in that. And then there's a breakup that never ends. You know, you get back together, then you break up, then you get back together, then you get, you know, time goes by, you get a haircut, you look different, you get back together. And that stuff never works because whatever broke the relationship is still there. You know?
And then there's the legal one, right? Divorce, right? Legally broken up.
Yes, the big one, the divorce. And I think divorce can be a lot more complicated because if there's kids involved, if there's property, it's so much more than a breakup. I mean, it's a complete life change and lots of conversations, negotiations, and, you know, all that.
So you're saying it's important to understand and dissect the type of breakup to understand what you need to recover from it and then for the next relationship.
Yes, yes. I mean, like if you went through a blindsided breakup, your nervous system is, you know, on alert and there's panic. So there's different things to focus on as opposed to, say, a flat soda breakup where there's probably not a lot of drama. There's a lot more peace and sadness.
how important this time of year, John, is it to maybe not get sucked into the holiday feelings, the new year that's coming up, and maybe think, well, maybe I should be in another relationship when maybe your relationship is actually doing okay?
Yeah, it's hard, you know, especially with social media and you see other people have what you want, whether that is the picket fence or running around with their partner and traveling the world. It's easy to feel lonely this time of year. And I would say try to find solitude and try for this year to be the year that you actually feel comfort in self, learning more about yourself, pursuing your passions, your dreams, everything that you want to do or you wanted to do before you got into a relationship and lost that. So connecting back to the spirit of you that you have disconnected with.
John, this interview, it's over. It's not you, it's me. I need to end it. So I'm very, very sorry. That's John Kim. His book is Breakup on Purpose, A Catalyst for Growth. John, thank you.
Thank you.
Now to a band famous for a breakup.
50 years ago, Fleetwood Mac welcomed two new members, Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks.
You can go your own way.
Their on-again, off-again relationship captivated fans and sparked hit songs. But before they joined the band in 1974, early Fleetwood Mac was hard to pin down.
I got a black magic woman. Got a black magic woman.
They were quite popular in England and Europe, and they were starting to gain popularity in the United States as a really good blues rock band.
Blues rock. Richie Unterberger has written more than a dozen books on rock music, including Fleetwood Mac, The Complete Illustrated History.
Their most famous song, easily, is Black Magic Woman, which Santana made into a big hit, but they did the original version.
The group had gone through changes to its lineup and its style. Meanwhile, Buckingham and Nicks had put out an album as a duo, which didn't sell very well.
So here's what happened next. A producer played that record for Mick Fleetwood of Fleetwood Mac. The band had a record to make, but the band's guitarist, singer, had just quit. So the call came on New Year's Eve. Fleetwood wanted Lindsey Buckingham.
And Lindsey Buckingham said, if I'm going to join the group, you have to also take Stevie Nicks, with whom he was in a romantic relationship still at that time. All of a sudden, they go from having one really good singer-songwriter in the group to three.
I love this song. Those harmonies and their new pop rock sound unlocked the American market. And Richie Unterberger says there was that chemistry.
What I think was unexpected was that rather quickly the relationship unraveled. But that didn't hurt the band's music or commercial prospects or even, I think, image, because people almost got interested in the soap opera aspect of it. The ups and downs of these relationships, which were being played out in public.
Which helps many listeners even today connect with Rumors, which is one of the best-selling albums of all time.
Time has a spell on you, but you won't forget me. I know I could have loved you, but you would not let me.
This is NPR News.
Former President Jimmy Carter has died. He's being remembered for his life of public service and commitment to human rights, which he spoke about in his inaugural address.
The powerful must not persecute the weak, and human dignity must be enhanced.
Stay with us on All Things Considered from NPR News for continuing coverage of the 39th president's life and legacy.
That story, plus the day's news from 3 until 6:30 on WPR.
This is WPR News.
Good morning. Thanks for being here on the final Monday of 2024 for Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:29. News starts now.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Biden says America and the world lost an extraordinary leader, statesman, and humanitarian with the death of former President Jimmy Carter. The nation's 39th president died yesterday at his home in Plains, Georgia, at the age of 100. Carter had been in hospice care for more than a year. NPR's John Ruwich says in addition to 1978's Camp David Accords, Carter was known for establishing diplomatic ties between the U.S. and China in 1979.
The establishment of diplomatic ties between Washington and Beijing helped bring China out of isolation and underpin the country's meteoric economic rise. For years, few questioned robust engagement, but the mood has shifted. President Trump launched a trade war against China during his first term, and President Biden has cast the country as a competitor and tried to limit its access to U.S. technology. A spokesperson for China's embassy in Washington paid tribute to Carter, though, saying the 39th president demonstrated, quote, extraordinary political courage and vision in normalizing ties with China. The spokesperson said China is ready to work with the U.S. to find what he called the right way to get along in the new era. John Ruwich, NPR News.
Investigators in South Korea are still assessing what caused yesterday's fiery crash of a domestic airliner as it was landing at Muwan International Airport. 179 people were killed.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. Electric vehicle owners will start paying a tax to recharge their batteries in public in 2025. The 3 cent per kilowatt tax is expected to raise between $3 and $4 million in each of the next 2 years to pay for road repairs. Verona's Libby Baldwin and her husband have owned an electric truck for the last year and a half. She says they'll only pay the tax on road trips because home chargers are exempt.
As of right now, the cost of charging on the road is still nothing compared to the cost of gas.
Businesses where the public pays to use a charger have to register with the State Department of Revenue to account for the new tax. Belden says a much bigger issue is whether the state has enough public chargers, especially in northern Wisconsin. The state plans to add 50 new chargers in 2025. Efforts are ongoing to fully map the bottom of the Great Lakes. Agencies and partners hope to better understand its depths, potential hazards, and support climate resilience in the face of extreme storms. The Michigan nonprofit Great Lakes Observing System has been leading the initiative. So far, 15% of the lake's floor have been mapped. The effort has charted most of the Wisconsin Shipwreck Coast National Marine Sanctuary. The sanctuary's superintendent, Russ Green, says the roughly 1,000 square mile sanctuary along Lake Michigan's coastline contains 40 shipwrecks. A bill introduced in Congress would provide $200 million to fully map the Great Lakes bottom, but so far has not advanced. Partners in the effort also hope to raise private funds. A power outage forced a delay and change of venue for a Division I Wisconsin college basketball program yesterday. UW Green Bay was supposed to tip off against Purdue Fort Wayne at 1 in the afternoon at the Resch Center. That's its usual home venue. But the team announced just before 2 in the afternoon that due to continuous power outages, the game would be moved to the Crest Center and tip-off pushed back until 2:45 in the afternoon. The team also said that due to that change in venue, the game would not be live-streamed on ESPN+, as previously planned. UW Green Bay ended up losing that game, falling to 2-14 on the season. More news available at WPR.org. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We have a childhood memory of the late Jimmy Carter's presidency. Carter was elected in 1976 when his grandson Jason Carter was 1 year old. When Carter lost re-election, Jason was five. In later years, he sometimes traveled with his grandfather as he worked in Africa. A few months ago, we called Jason Carter to talk about these times.
So I have a lot of memories of being in the White House as any sort of toddler and 5 year old in kindergarten. You know, when I would go visit my grandparents, we would go to their house and it just happened to be the White House. They did their very best, I think, to just stay normal people. And that's one of the things that I think is fundamentally true about my grandparents is they were these two folks from a small town in South Georgia when they went into the White House, and they were those exact same people when they came out.
Do you remember when he lost in 1980?
I do, actually. We were in the White House. We were watching TV, and you could tell that the grown-ups were getting disappointed. And for me, after that, we had other things that happened in my life where we moved and did some other things that made a bigger impact on me. But I do remember the night.
You couldn't have been happy.
I don't remember it being a big deal to me, because the people that I knew in that White House were still going to be my grandparents. It was still going to be my parents. We were just going to go to a different place. And, you know, I'm not sure I had an understanding of, you know, the fact that they were going to take the solar panels off the roof of the White House, the fact that they were going to, you know, turn back the clock on a variety of things or move on to different things, right? I wasn't really aware in that same way that it was a loss for the family.
I want to jump ahead here now and note that when you grew up, in later years, you ran for governor of Georgia, a job that your grandfather once had held, and you lost. Did the way that he handled defeat inform the way that you handled defeat?
Absolutely. When I ran for governor, I knew it was a long shot, and my grandfather told me, you know, there's a lot worse things than losing an election. And I do think that watching him go through an election where he was very disappointed to lose, and yet still come forward and do the remarkable things that he has done over the last four decades, it makes you realize that there are things that are so much more important than political victory. And ultimately, as my friend says, you know, history casts the final ballot on whatever it is that you're doing. And politics is pretty temporary in that way.
Each former president approaches the post-presidency in different ways. How did your grandfather think of his?
I think my grandfather was really driven by his faith and his desire to do what he could to help others, and particularly the most marginalized people in the world. And so for him, the Carter Center was really designed to be a place of peace and ultimately to be a place of fighting disease. And my grandfather focused heavily on neglected tropical diseases, which essentially afflicted only the poorest people in the world, most of whom were in Africa. And he spent his life since the White House really promoting and partnering with communities at the very end of the road to both bring human rights and health care and empowerment to those partners of his. And I think it was an incredibly fulfilling thing to watch.
I am remembering occasions where he was willing to weigh in on a controversial topic. We could talk about Israel-Palestine and his opinions there. I'm also remembering an occasion where, before the U.S. restored relations with Cuba, that he visited Cuba and gave a speech in Cuba, which the communist authorities allowed to be broadcast across the island, but that was a controversial choice. What did he think about in those kinds of instances?
You know, I think my grandfather, certainly once he left the White House and probably while he was in the White House, just decided he wanted to do the right thing and sort of let the politics be damned. And it got him some tension with sitting presidents for a time or two. But he really just believed that it made more sense for him, who had his platform, to get up and tell the truth and do what he thinks is right, even if it's going to be controversial. And he deployed it, sometimes to great effect and sometimes just to controversy.
I'm also thinking about somebody who travels the world and then comes back to Georgia and teaches Sunday school, which he continued until fairly recently. Isn't that right?
I think my grandfather taught Sunday school almost 30 Sundays a year in Plains, and it was at his church. And that's one of the things that kept him grounded, that helped him sort of maintain that moral center. Certainly, I think if you asked him what was his favorite thing to do, I think he would tell you teach Sunday school and work in his wood shop.
Oh, interesting. And related somehow spiritually. I am remembering reading in one of his books that he described himself, I think, as a red letter Baptist, meaning that he put greatest emphasis on the words of Jesus Christ that are in red in the Bible, and you give a lot less weight to everything else. Is that right?
Well, I think really, truly, my grandfather tried to base his life on Jesus's. And I think there's a lot of certainly the public face of Christianity that has lost some of that red text, as you might call it, where we're looking at how really it, what it means to live and model your life after Jesus. And I do think my grandfather did that. And I think that meant that it drove him to deal with the least of these, right? The commandment to love your neighbor as yourself.
The more we're talking, I'm sorry about this, I keep remembering other things I've read by this guy, because I read a lot of these books that he wrote over the years. An occasion that he recounts when he's in the White House, it's the late 70s, some religious conservatives come to visit him in the White House, and they have a nice meeting, as President Carter recounts it. But then on the way out, one of the pastors in this meeting says words to the effect of, "I wish you'd become a Christian." He did not even accept this person with liberal policies as a Christian. Did that happen much?
You know, I think he certainly was perhaps controversial among some of the politicized Christian right. But I think really these days, what you see is a huge number of Christians in this country and around the world inspired by his work. You know, his work building houses with Habitat for Humanity, his work doing good works for the poor across the world in a way that I think recounts to people that same faith story that my grandfather has lived out.
I'm thinking about surveys in which Americans are asked, is the country moving in the right direction? And majorities of people for years and years have said, no, we're not moving in the right direction. Your grandfather has had this very long perspective, though, a political career going back to 1962. If we could ask him, is the country moving in the right direction? Has it moved in the right direction during your lifetime? What do you think he'd say?
Oh, I think my grandfather in these 100 years has seen the most remarkable transformation of our country that you could imagine for the better, right? I mean, he grew up in a segregated South that has been transformed into a place where, you know, people participate and lead multiracial coalitions. We've seen so many of those issues come forward. We've transformed the healthcare of our people. We've changed the world in so many ways. I think the progress of this globe and of this country during my grandfather's life is something that he marvels at. And I think if the rest of us really look at it, we'd all marvel at it.
Jason Carter, it's a real pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Likewise, thank you so much.
Jimmy Carter's grandson spoke with us in September. Jason also talked of his grandfather's life as a writer, and you can find that conversation at npr.org. This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 8:42. It is a Monday, and there's still lots more to get to this hour on the program. One of the major headlines over the past couple of weeks, not just across the country, but especially here in Wisconsin, has been the state of the bird flu outbreak across the United States. We'll hear about the outbreak and how to keep yourself and pets safe coming up in just about 3 minutes on WPR.
Make it a winter of wonder with help from PBS Wisconsin Education. Visit pbswisconsin.org/education to find free kit-tested games, programs, and hands-on activities. Spark curiosity and learning wherever the season takes you, at school, at home, or on the go, on your TV, tablets, and mobile devices. Explore a wonderful world of education now at pbswisconsin.org/education.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Dells, offering getaway experiences such as spas, dining, and scenic wonders. More about getaways at wisdells.com. Wisconsin Dells, the water park capital of the world.
Support comes from the law offices of Frank J. Parise, specializing in criminal defense, traffic, and DUIs. 262-656-9906. The law offices of Frank J. Parise since 1985. Located in Kenosha at 7001 30th Avenue.
On Wisconsin Public Radio at 844, here's what's happening in news. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter passed away yesterday at the age of 100. Several leaders are releasing statements on Carter's life and death, including President Joe Biden, who said that the world had lost, quote, an extraordinary leader, statesman, and humanitarian. Governor Tony Evers called Carter a, quote, committed and dedicated advocate for peace, human rights, and treating others with dignity, decency, and respect. A Wisconsin appeals court has ruled that the state is on the hook for more than $240,000 in legal fees related to the state's investigation into the 2020 election. And a power outage forced a delay and change of venue for UW Green Bay's men's basketball game yesterday. More news at WPR.org. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Every week seems to bring some revelation about bird flu. For example, the outbreak in dairy cattle recently led California to declare a state of emergency. So NPR's Will Stone has been trying to make sense of the situation. Hey there, Will.
Hey, Steve.
Okay, bottom line question for a lot of people. Should people be worried about catching bird flu?
The short answer here is no, at least for most of us. The risk is considered low, and that's because almost everyone who's been infected in the U.S. had some kind of close contact with infected animals, either cattle or poultry. Mm. There have been more than 65 human cases so far. Only a few could not be traced back to an infected animal. So luckily, this is still essentially a virus that's evolved to infect birds, not humans. It does not look like the strain circulating widely in wild birds and other animals, like cattle, has gained some of the key mutations it would need to spread easily between humans in the way that seasonal influenza does.
Gotcha. Well, when you said close contact with animals in most cases, what does close contact mean? What's the definition?
Yeah, so generally in the past with H5N1 bird flu, that's meant people who were slaughtering birds, handling them, defeathering them, preparing them. The recent cases we've seen in poultry workers in the U.S. happened because they were culling commercial flocks that were infected. I spoke to Richard Webby about this. He's a virologist at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital.
You would have to be handling that animal, if you like, making a mess and sort of aerosolizing virus particles from the bird. So it really has to be close, close contact.
Meaning close enough to get a lot of virus deep in your lungs or all over your face, maybe after rubbing your nose and eyes. Webby says this is not something you need to stress about when you're filling up your bird feeder or if you somehow touch a bit of poop on your deck. The advice here is just wash your hands afterwards and, of course, not to mess with wild birds in the first place.
Good idea for a number of reasons. Yes. But what about the cases in dairy cattle?
Here it's a little less clear, and simply because until this past year, Steve, scientists had never seen bird flu spreading widely in these animals. That said, there's strong evidence now that raw milk is harboring high loads of this virus and that farm workers are catching this from cattle during the milking process. They're being splashed in the face. Raw milk is potentially being aerosolized in the milking parlor and they're breathing it in. So again, this is a person being exposed to potentially a lot of virus.
Are people's pets at risk?
We do know that all kinds of mammals, including cats and dogs, can catch bird flu, and it can be serious, even fatal. The recommendation is keep them away from wild birds, also mice if possible, because the virus is still very widespread. Kristen Coleman at the University of Maryland has actually analyzed the data on bird flu in cats. She says cats can have respiratory symptoms, but it can also look like a neurological illness.
It often mimics rabies. So if your cat or your dog starts acting funny, maybe rabid, make sure to contact a veterinarian right away.
Coleman says a key point here is that cats are mostly getting infected because they've consumed tainted raw milk or raw meat, which is sometimes sold as pet food.
You've reassured us here for the most part about the limiting factors in the spread of this disease. What could change all that?
If we see a lot of human cases that can't be traced back to infected animals, or if there's evidence of spread between humans.
I'm reminded of that phrase, community spread, that we all learned during the pandemic.
That's right.
Will, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
And NPR's Will Stone. This is NPR News.
and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. Got about 11 minutes left in the program now. Of course, news is coming up at 9 o'clock, and Wisconsin Today coming up after that. If you want to look back on anything from our show, hey, there's a really interesting episode of Wisconsin Today Morning News, our podcast that is out today, a political roundup from the state in 2024. Again, that's Wisconsin Today Morning News. You'll find that wherever you get your podcasts and at WPR.org.
I'm Gregory Berg. The studios of WGTD will be closed from December 28th through January 1st for the holidays, and during that time there will be no morning show broadcast. But each and every day there will be a different morning show podcast episode for you to enjoy, with interviews drawn from the morning show archives. The podcast version of the morning show is available wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, but be sure to look for the right name, The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
It's morning edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In sports, the Green Bay Packers made a comeback yesterday, but they ended up falling short against the Minnesota Vikings, Minnesota getting the win 27-25. The Packers have one game left in the regular season now, taking on the Chicago Bears at home this Sunday. That will start at noon. The Milwaukee Bucks lost to the Chicago Bulls over the weekend. They'll be back in action tomorrow, taking on the Indiana Pacers. That one starts at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. In weather, the majority of Wisconsin under a dense fog advisory, especially in the northern half of the state. That'll be lasting until about noon today. Otherwise, mostly cloudy throughout. Could see some pockets of sunshine in the south, with high temperatures above average for this time of year, in the 30s and 40s. More clouds and fog across the state overnight. Could see a wintry mix in the south, with low temperatures in the 20s and 30s. This is WPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. More than 1,000 North Korean soldiers fighting for Russia were killed or injured in a single week in clashes in Ukraine. That's according to the latest estimates from U.S. officials. Military experts say it appears North Korean soldiers are being sent into battle with little equipment or preparation. NPR's Brian Mann reports.
Intelligence reports first became public in October that North Korea was sending soldiers to bolster Russia's army. Military analyst George Barros with the Institute for the Study of War, a nonpartisan think tank in Washington, D.C., says it soon became clear Pyongyang was deploying some of its best trained troops.
The North Koreans have sent roughly a division's worth of troops from the North Korean 11th Corps, which is North Korea's special forces.
By November, Ukraine's general military staff was reporting they were already facing squads of North Koreans in the Kursk region, a part of Russia occupied by Ukraine where heavy fighting is underway. But Barrow says intelligence reports from open sources and Ukrainian and U.S. officials show Russia is sending these North Korean soldiers against heavily fortified positions without proper planning, coordination, or equipment.
One-fourth of those Korean forces have been made casualties. The current estimate is about 3,000.
His estimate is somewhat higher than the number provided by U.S. officials, but in a briefing with reporters Friday, White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby gave a similar account of how the North Koreans are being deployed.
North Korean forces are conducting massed, dismounted assaults against Ukrainian positions in Kursk. Now, these human wave tactics that we're seeing haven't really been all that effective.
Kirby says there are credible accounts from the battlefield of North Koreans committing suicide after their assaults fail.
Rather than surrendering to Ukrainian forces, likely out of fear of reprisal against their families in North Korea in the event that they're captured.
Moscow and Pyongyang haven't acknowledged North Korean soldiers are fighting in Kursk. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky confirmed in a statement last week his soldiers are now in regular contact with North Korean fighters. They have many losses, Zelensky said, and we see the Russian military and North Korean overseers are not at all interested in their survival. While it appears the North Koreans aren't being used effectively, military analysts and U.S. officials acknowledge this additional manpower backing Russia puts new strain on Ukraine's army, which faces a grim troop shortage of its own. Still, George Barros with the Institute for the Study of War says the presence of North Korean soldiers shows Russia is also desperate for troops at a time when Moscow is losing an estimated 30,000 men killed and wounded every month.
yes, they have a net manpower advantage. However, the Russian system for fourth generation is really struggling to offset that 30,000 casualties per month figure. The North Koreans provided 10 days worth of casualties with that initial 10K investment.
So far, Barrow says these North Korean fighters haven't been a game changer. More important, he says, Pyongyang has emerged as a major supplier of artillery, shells, and ammunition to Russia, allowing Moscow to maintain a grinding offensive this winter, which has steadily gained ground. Brian Mann, NPR News, Kyiv.
In the year that's now ending, some countries made a lot of progress against disease. It is, to be clear, exceedingly rare that the whole world eradicates an illness. Vaccines played a huge role in fighting smallpox, which the World Health Organization declared to be wiped out in 1980. But each year, some countries say they are free of disease, and that happened 9 times this year. For example, Egypt became malaria-free. Brazil eliminated a disfiguring disease called elephantiasis, and one country got rid of a disease that can cause blindness, as NPR's Gabriela Emanuel reports.
As a young boy in Pakistan, Asad Aslam Khan would visit his father's farming village outside of Lahore. It's surrounded by sugarcane and rice fields, but what Khan remembers is all the people who could not farm.
I used to feel very bad that this patient is having red eye, watery eye, and he is in pain. That was a miserable situation.
Miserable because they had a condition called trachoma. It's caused by repeated bacterial infections as a child, and as a result, in adulthood, the eyelashes turn inward and scratch the surface of the eye. It's known for being incredibly painful, and for nearly 2 million people globally, it causes blurry vision and eventually blindness.
And I couldn't do at that time much about them. I wish I could do something for those poor people.
Now, fast forward some 50 years, and Khan, who's an ophthalmologist and chair of the government's trachoma task force, has done something.
By the grace of Almighty Allah, we now have become trachoma-free country.
The World Health Organization made it official. Over the years, 21 countries have eliminated trachoma. Anthony Solomon is with WHO.
It's a massive effort that requires mobilization of hundreds or thousands of healthcare workers and other personnel.
He says there's a pretty standard elimination strategy. Antibiotics given in mass to stop the infection, a simple surgery to reposition the intern eyelashes for those already with advanced trachoma, and the final piece of the strategy, improving people's access to running water for face washing and toilets so the bacteria behind trachoma can't spread. The toilets weren't initially a hit, says Munaza Gilani of the non-governmental organization Sight Savers, which helped build latrines. People were used to relieving themselves in an open field, she says.
They found it really strange to have a toilet within their homes, and they thought it's not a hygienic practice.
So, she says, they started by putting toilets in places people trusted, where they could gain acceptance.
We first built them in the mosques and schools, and then in some communal places.
Eventually, she says, people started liking the toilets. Khan says a lot has changed in 2 decades. When the elimination campaign got underway, hundreds of thousands of people were treated for active trachoma. Today, trachoma is no longer a public health concern in Pakistan. They've succeeded.
Everyone was so happy. Many had tears in their eyes. I can't explain their faces, the jubilation on their faces, the smile on their faces.
Khan says as a boy, he never expected to see this moment in his lifetime. Gabriela Emanuel, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Alex Crow, and that'll do it for Morning Edition on this Monday here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Really appreciate you making some time for us this morning. Wisconsin Today is on the way.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from many small retailers. Local independent stores in downtowns across Wisconsin are open and stocked for holiday gift shopping. Shopping small supports local neighborhood businesses.
Support comes from Sylvan Learning of Kenosha, offering personalized tutoring from certified teachers that's designed to inspire, convenient scheduling, and affordable hourly rates. Explore the options, search Sylvan Learning of Kenosha, or call 262-694-6286.